Hello and welcome to the Ship Shape Podcast, a series of podcasts where we meet amazing people and talk about their experiences, personal, technical, and all related to the maritime world. Come and dive in. Dive in. Dive in.
Today on the Ship Shape Podcast, we have Nigel Calder, boat tech guru, author of Marine Diesel Engines, Nigel's Cruising Handbook, and Boat Owner's Mechanical and Electrical Manual, to name a few. Today's hosts are Meryl Charette. I'm a live aboard on a Tashing Toshiba 36, and T.
Hey guys, welcome to the Ship Shape Podcast. This is Talahavati. I am aboard my powerboat of 40-foot lures, and honestly, it's such a pleasure to have Nigel on the show with us, because this guy is the first book I ever bought when I got on a boat like 10, 12 years ago was this guy's book. And so such a pleasure to have you on the show, Nigel. Welcome.
So thank Nigel, you. Where are you recording this from?
I'm at home in Maine, mid-coast Maine, looking out on the Damariscotta River.
What town are you in Maine?
Well, it's actually Newcastle, but most people know it as Damariscotta. We're on opposite side to the river.
Maine must be pretty cold this time of year.
It's getting chilly. It was pretty good frost last night. It went down to 18 degrees, I think.
So, wow. Nigel, you've had incredible career in boating and in writing, but where did this all start? I know at one point you were on oil rigs, but prior to that, how did this entry into maritime happen?
Well, I grew up kind of in the middle of the south of England, so there was no water nearby. But I went to a Church of England summer camp when I was, I guess, 12 years old. And they had a couple of Wayfarer dinghies on the south coast of England. And I just got into sailing instantly. Just loved it. And then at school, what would be called, this is called high school in the States, me and a friend got our mothers on sports day to take us off to sail. And they had a dinghy on a flooded gravel pit near where we lived. So we went sailing instead of doing soccer or hockey or nice. Whatever everybody else was doing.
And that's where the love affair started.
Yep. And then I was, in high school in the 60s. And that's when they had the first round the world race. And it was sponsored by one of the big newspapers in England. So it got headline news. And it got a whole ton of us fired up with the idea of sailing around the world.
Nice.
So I would sit at the school doodling and drawing pictures of junks and stuff like that and figuring I was going to sail around the world.
Well, wow. You certainly come from that time frame in which recreational sailing and boating became such a phenomenon. What was it like back in the day?
Well, the other aspect to this was home building, because the boats were a lot simpler. And so a ton of people got into home building, especially in the 70s. And we did the same. I met my girlfriend, currently my wife now. We've been together for 50 years in 1971. I took her sailing across the North Sea on my brother's boat. We got run down by a ship on the way back. He did a lot of damage. We didn't lose the boat, but it was a pretty scary incident. So I couldn't get her near a seagoing boat for years, so we built a couple of canal boats in England, steel canal boats. We bought the hulls, and then we built them out from there. And then finally, after 7 or 8 years, I persuaded her to get back into sailboating. So then we took a bare hull for a 39-foot sailboat and built that into a cruising boat. So we spent basically the better part of 10 or 12 years building those boats and learning about boat construction and boat systems and so on.
So this first boat that you were on that got hit by another ship, I'm sure there's a lesson to be learned there. What was the story behind that?
Well, this was back in the early 70s. You know, we didn't have any electricity on our boat. It had kerosene navigation lights and interior lighting. We had a lead line for depths. We had no VHF radio, and the engine was hand cranked. It was a gasoline engine from the 1920s. You had to unscrew the spark plugs, pour some gas in the cylinders to prime them, screw the spark plugs back in, and then crank it. And sometimes it would start in forwards, and sometimes it would backfire and just about break your wrist. So we were becalmed in the North Sea at night with the ship bearing down on us, and we didn't have the time to crank the engine, and we couldn't get out of the way. So I'm not sure there's much of a lesson there, other than it's handy to have an engine that will crank at the push of a button.
Yep. Gotta love technology, right?
Yeah. we could see it was going to hit us. We didn't have an opportunity to get out of the way.
Okay. Wow. And was the weather stormy, or were you guys just like?
No, it was flat calm. It was like a mill pond. And in fact, it was a wooden boat, and the ship hit us in the stern, and it split the planking on both sides just above the waterline, and displaced the transom sideways quite a bit. So we had, gaping holes in the boat. If there'd been any wave action whatsoever, the boat would have sunk. But as it was, it continued to float, and they had to tow us back to Holland to get repaired, and then that was a whole other issue because we didn't have any money and we weren't insured. And it wasn't my boat, it was my brother's boat, and he was in Canada, and I hadn't told him I was taking it. So there were quite a lot of other knock-on issues here, should we say.
I imagine. And then, but that didn't stop you at all. Like, then after that, you went on to buy your own boat as well.
Well, then we built the two canal boats. The English canal system was dug before there were engines. So they were all horse-drawn barges, and the biggest barge that a horse could pull was about 25 tons of cargo. And so the canals were built to accommodate boats that would do that. And they were basically 70 feet long and 6 foot 10 and a half inches wide. Don't ask me why that. And the locks themselves on the English canal system are 72 feet long and 7 feet wide. So we built a couple of 70-foot canal boats. So in the locks, we had 3/4 of an inch clearance on the sides, and a foot at each end. And then because, the locks were built 200 years ago in the 1700s, some of the bricks have swelled. So occasionally you get a bit stuck going up and down through a sort of clearance. And then the weight of the boat going down would take it down and the water would push it up. So we spent 6 years building and living on those boats.
And then not a lot of people do that.
No, almost no.
Got you into that at all?
You know, it was that era where we all thought we could do anything till we turned our hands to, and that we'd figure it out as we went along. From what I know now about galvanic corrosion, I'm sure both of those boats are probably at the bottom of the canal system, because we knew nothing about those kinds of issues. And then the first boat, again, had no electrical system. It had propane lighting and heating and a hand-cranked engine, a big old pre-Second World War hand-cranked diesel engine. And the second boat had an electrical system, which was my first experience of building electrical systems.
So, and then at what point did you start working on oil rigs? What did that look like? I know that you had some interesting experiences in that field.
Yes, we came to the States in 1978, and I started looking for work, and discovered I could make 3 times as much money working in oil fields in the Gulf of Mexico as I was making in England. So I never went home. I was totally unqualified for the job I got. I got a job as an oil field mechanic and electrician. And as you can tell from what I've already told you, my electrical experience was pretty limited at that point. I got the job by paying a $2,000 cash bribe to the mechanics foreman for this particular oil company I was working for. And then I had to learn rather quickly, because they had, three-phase 440-volt electrical systems.
You could fry yourself easily.
Yeah, I had to learn really fast. I had had a fair amount of big diesel experience by that point, because my last job in England had been in a foundry, off-the-grid foundry, which had half a dozen generators varying from 500 horsepower to 3,500. So I had a fair amount of big engine experience, but almost no electrical experience. So I'm pretty quick at picking stuff up. I only got shocked off a ladder once and a few other times. So I got the hang of it pretty quickly.
Okay. And have you been writing in the background yet on anything, or has it started at all?
I messed my back up on the oil rigs. I ruptured a couple of discs and realized I'd have to get into something else. And at that point, we were pretty much finished with building our 39-foot boat in the States and ready to go cruising. So and I had a lot of diesel engine experience, both small and big. So backing up a tiny bit, I had built the refrigeration systems on our boat out of a book, basically. I went to the library and figured out.
Yeah, people used to do that back in the day, right?
Yeah, and it never worked very well. So then I had to rebuild it. And then finally I figured that stuff out. So I wrote a little book on how to how to build a marine refrigeration system, and I tried to find a publisher for it, and I couldn't. But the publisher came back and said, well, how about a book on diesel engines? So I said, sure. So that was the origins of my marine diesel engines, and that sold fairly well right out of the gate and has continued to sell ever since. Actually, we're on the edition. And then as a result of that, the publisher asked for what became the boat owner's mechanical and electrical manual. And by that point, you know, we had built three boats, two of them with electrical systems. I had learned a fair bit about boat electrical systems, and and there was no published knowledge on these kinds of systems. So I said no. I said the book's too much work, and then the publisher found two other people. He said maybe the three of us could do it together. And I said, there's no way I'm sharing the royalties. You know, there's not enough
boat book. Yeah, after all that work.
Sorry, that pushed me over the edge into writing the first edition. And then as soon as that was published, I got a bunch of snotty letters from an organization called the American Boat and Yacht Council, which writes the electrical standards for American recreational boat building. And because there were a number of prescriptions in the book that violated their standards. So I started going to their meetings, and I've been going ever since. And we went very rapidly to a second edition to clean the book up from a standards perspective. And then I've been going to that ABYC for over 30 years now. And I've learned a huge amount just from those interactions.
So that's cool. But
yeah, every time
I bet at some level, Nigel, tell me this, is that like you didn't see yourself becoming like the authority on the subject or anything, right? But you are now.
What I realized was there was a need for this knowledge. And I'm a journalist rather than, you know, I have a degree in philosophy. So I don't have a degree in electrical engineering or anything like that. But what I did when I realized on the first edition of the book there was a need for this knowledge, I went round boat shows talking to the then gurus of the day, people like Steve Proctor and Dave Smead and Bill Montgomery from Balmar. And essentially I picked their brains. And then what I did was to codify that knowledge. So it's not much of it's not my knowledge. What I do, I now have a Rolodex, you know, of hundreds, if not a couple of thousand people that really know what they're talking about in the industry. And so my job is to take that knowledge and to put it into a format where it's accessible to non-technical people. So that's really what I've specialized in doing. And of course, in the process, I've gotten to learn a lot. Until finally, I got to doing some original research and development where I thought we could push the envelope with these systems. But for the first couple of decades, basically all I was doing was codifying other people's knowledge.
Definitely dig deeper into that, pushing it further a bit, right? I think Merrill has a question first.
So you have been doing a lot of research when it comes to battery technology, and you've seen it develop over time. What is the current state of batteries, you know, from where they started to where they're at now?
Well, interestingly enough, everybody thinks in terms of lithium ion, but in the lead acid world, there's more development going on than probably at any time in the history of battery development. So there's constant improvements being made there. But the real movement, of course, is in the lithium ion world, where we've got four times the energy density, you know, a quarter of the volume for the same performance. And in fact, because you can routinely use most of the capacity in a lithium ion battery, whereas you can't in a lead acid battery, then it looks even better. So the lithium ion world is just opening up all kinds of new opportunities in terms of electric propulsion and hybrid systems and so on.
So, Nigel, you started in the industry back when it was hand-cranked engines, and it's developed over time to such an extreme on your end. It's hard to really
at least two
like,
generations,
conceptualize.
Right? From hand-crank to machine-crank to electric crank, right?
Well, so, yes, of course, the hand crank was ancient when I had it as well. But we had lots of electric crank motors in those days. But still, our first sailboat that we built was both electric and hand. We could hand crank it.
So how have you seen the industry develop over time, and kind of where is it headed, especially with all the technology that's happening on the battery front?
Well, in general, there's a mind-boggling level of integration going on now. We've got so much information flowing around our boats, and it's all getting brought onto the same networks and then displayed on our multifunction displays. So an unbelievable level of integration, and that's ongoing. it gets more and more centralized every year, which is has some wonderful side effects in terms of display and user interface and so on, but obviously some serious downsides in terms of troubleshooting if anything goes wrong. Most of these systems are well beyond the competence of any of us, myself included, to troubleshoot. In fact, on my own boat, I have a digital switching system. It was a first-generation system that we put in 2006 or 7, I think. And it's obsolete, and the company went out of business in 2018. And if that system fails, which it will at some point, I am totally unable to fix it. I'll have to rewire the entire boat because there's no support for it anymore and no parts.
Mm.
So there's a definite downside to integrating everything.
Well, that brings up a pretty good topic. You know, one of the things that I've seen in the industry with the short time I've been in it is that all these new technologies are coming around, yet there's not a good support system behind many of the things that are coming out. Can you speak on that a little bit?
That's a huge problem. Typically speaking, the education of marine technicians takes place in the boat builder or the boat yard and is based on previous knowledge. There's not much opportunity for people to access new knowledge, and the necessary knowledge has just increased exponentially over the last decade. So there's an unbelievable shortage of qualified technicians, both on the installation side and also on the service side. I have a presentation I do every once in a while on common electrical mistakes on boats. Almost all of the illustrations or photographs in that presentation come from new boats that I inspected at the Annapolis Boat Show. The boat builders just having trouble keeping up with all of this, let alone the technicians in the field. One of the reasons I launched a year ago a website, it's www.boathowto.com, boathowto.com, which is basically online marine electrical education. It's not free, it's subscription-based. But one of the reasons we did that is because there is no good source of this kind of information for people, and it's really seriously needed. And much of the information that's out on the internet is at best incorrect and sometimes dangerous. So what we're trying to do is create a go-to website with reliable education that complies with the various boat building standards, the American Boat and Yacht Council, the ISO in Europe, and so on. And so far, we've got a basic electrical course, and we've just launched an advanced marine electrical course. And over time, we'll just keep adding more content to the site.
I was at a boat show. I was at IBEX, and I was talking to one of the bigger CEOs of an engine company we all know of, but I'm not going to mention it here. And I was talking to him about his new engine with the interconnected systems. And I was like, oh, well, you know, this is very mechanical, but now you need to have like a whole understanding of hardcore electronics. Who's going to service this? And he was like, oh, well, the boat dealers will. And I'm like, the boat dealers? They sell a boat, they wipe their hands clean, and they say good luck.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, he said, yeah, it's going to be bad.
I know a boat builder, they put in, this is a big trawler yachts, they put in a couple of man diesels, I'm not sure what, probably 600 or 700 horsepower, maybe 800, common rail, high pressure common rail engines, and one of them had an intermittent fault that was driving everybody nuts. It took them 8 hours of expensive time to track down a poor connection in one of the plugs in the engine harness.
And oh boy.
Because these engines are so sophisticated, they see the slightest little blip in one of the sensors, they shut the engine down. So there are definite downsides to this technology.
So you're a big proponent of sustainability and sustainable yachting. And how does that, this sort of thing, I know you're making a website, you're trying to sort of remedy the situation, but how does this sort of transcend that and sort of become sustainable and not, you know, you need, again, to spend so much man hour or materials, or again, it just becomes obsolete. Here's, you have to buy the new one, get the upgrade, or it doesn't fit into the system. How do we get beyond that?
Well, in the bigger picture, I actually believe climate change is real, unlike some people in the States. And we have to reduce our carbon footprint. And I think politically, it's going to be unacceptable for us to continue to run gas guzzling and diesel guzzling engines in our boats for pleasure. And I think that's going to happen sooner than many people expect. So we have to move to some form of non-carbon polluting energy systems on our boats for propulsion and house energies. And right now, the only real way of doing this is through electrification. And the assumption there being that when we go in and plug in at the dock, that the electricity is also coming from a carbon neutral source, which of course it mostly isn't at the moment. Mm-hmm. But there's no way with current battery technology, which is the only way we have of storing energy, electrical energy on a boat, there's no way that we can get sufficient storage to have any decent range under power on a boat. So we can electrify all short-range boating nowadays with the latest generation lithium-ion batteries, but we still need a fossil fuel engine for substantial propulsion loads. Although I think, and I don't see that changing in the next 5 or 10 years, which means we're going to run into a problem with public perception that we shouldn't be running these engines and the fact that we don't really have an alternative. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a solution there. In the aviation industry, they have a similar problem. And they've now developed ways of making jet fuel, carbon neutral jet fuel. Basically, they do carbon capture. And then they take water and they crack it into hydrogen and oxygen using solar power. And then they blend the hydrogen with the captured carbon and they make a hydrocarbon. They make kerosene and then they can run planes on it. And this technology actually works. So I think we will have mechanisms to create carbon neutral fuels that will extend the life of our diesel and gasoline engines and enable us to get over the hump until we can go fully electric or some other technology becomes viable. Mm.
So what other things need to happen? And, you know, we keep talking about kind of the boats themselves, but in terms of infrastructure, when it comes to just marinas, is there anything that needs to happen in order to make electric engines more viable?
Sure. Back in the 60s, there was a lake in Austria that went fossil fuel free. So even way back then, they were building, and they had a lot of people that liked to water ski on the lake. So they were building boats with humongous battery banks and huge electric motors and water skiing. Well, on a Saturday evening, they'd all go back to the dock and plug in to recharge the batteries. And they actually crashed the substation to the local town. So they had to build a new substation to handle the loads. We're going to have similar kinds of issues. If we dramatically increase the pace of electrification, the shoreside infrastructure is really going to get stressed out. And in particular, if we have high-capacity battery banks that we want to charge fast, we've got to have humongous electrical capabilities on the dock. So there's a whole process that has to take place here. The only country that I know of that's putting a lot of effort into the marine side of this at the moment is Norway, and they're putting in charging stations in a lot of their marinas so that people can coast hop around Norway in electric-powered boats and be able to get into a new marina and charge in and then go to the next one.
Nice.
Much in the same way that we have infrastructure for electric cars now on land, we need similar kind of infrastructure in our marinas.
So, Nigel, let me get your take on this. I mean, I agree with the whole electrification of things. In fact, California's already said by 2030, they're not going to allow any more, you know, gas cars or petrol cars or whatever. And that's only, you know, 5 years later, it's going to be marine, etc. What I'm seeing on the other side, though, is, for example, again, one of these new engine manufacturers, we don't need to name them, but they've, in their advert, you know, which you can go watch on YouTube, they've said that, you know, they've made deals with boatyards where these engines can, the new ones, the electric ones, can only go in on new boats. And to me, that's sad because, again, like a lot of these older boats, their hull value, just the fiberglass in there, is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes. They don't make boats that well anymore. And they're basically going to sink all of them. Yeah, they're just going to make them obsolete, render them obsolete. And is that, yeah, are we achieving what we want to if we're trying to be carbon neutral, et cetera, and we're essentially making, yeah, they probably make reefs out of them for all we know. Yeah.
Yeah, there's just so many variables at work in these kinds of discussions. I mean, because then there's the whole element of what did it take to make the electric motors and the batteries and so on. Much of the time, that whole process is nowhere near carbon neutral. And and then there's all of the politics of like the cobalt that we've got in many of our lithium-ion batteries. A significant amount of that is mined with child labor in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And then the processes for extracting the lithium salts are often very environmentally unfriendly. So there's a massive of issues and problems related with all of this technology, and we're kind of fumbling our way through it. And I certainly don't have any answers. I do think it's... I'm an environmentalist, you know. I do believe in reducing our carbon footprint to the minimum. I think we have to do it, especially for I'm older than you guys. I'm going to die before the shit really hits the fan, but we have to think about our children.
And their children.
We absolutely have to get this under control, but we don't have a clear path to that at the moment. We're still struggling with all of these issues. And in fact, I was on a conference call yesterday with the National Marine Manufacturers Association that was looking at a number of these issues and trying to figure out what's the right way forward. We have to figure it out pretty quickly. We have to be willing to take some fairly radical steps, even if they hurt. And that is a big part of the problem. Of course, people are trying to avoid taking painful decisions and instead looking for an easy way out. There probably isn't an easy way out of this whole situation.
Well, there was this proposed restriction on all boats over 35 feet having a 10 knot speed limit. So I was sitting there being like, well, that's the quickest way to get everyone electric. There's no point of owning these giant diesel engines anymore.
Yeah, but politically, you'll never get that through. I mean, I've been in Miami on a boat where they had 750 horsepower outboards on the back of it.
Oh, boy.
I can tell those people that they got a 10 mile an hour speed limit. But I do think there's going to be actually some interim fuels for some of these engines that are carbon neutral, which will help to extend the period in which we can engage in the transition. But obviously the focus has to be on getting away from any form of fossil fueled engine, carbon neutral or otherwise, into other forms of transportation.
So when are boats going to have nuclear reactors? Is that ever going to...
I'll let you do the testing on those.
Build it, metal, drive it.
Make sure you're well at sea and downwind of me when you're doing it.
But so tell us more about the projects that like you've been working on. You mentioned alternators and solar, and you talked a little about the How-To website. Maybe
about this reduction in emissions. When we run an engine to drive a propeller, the propeller never loads the engine to peak efficiency. It's just the nature of the way engines develop power and propellers absorb it. And almost always, up until you get to close to wide open throttle, if you can add load to the engine, it makes it more efficient. So we realized in the testing that we did on our first project that was funded by the European Union, that if we could basically transfer most of the generating that takes place on boats, and particularly on boats that have a standalone generator, if we could transfer that generating load to the engine when it's underway, we could substantially improve the efficiency of the engine from a propulsion point of view. We could also harvest the electrical energy way, way more efficiently than we do with a standalone generator. So we got into that whole project and we developed something called the Integral System, which is basically an alternator on steroids with a fancy control system. And that belts on the front of the engine where you would put another alternator. And that thing will produce, when it's cold, 9 kilowatts of energy out of an alternator. When it's hot, it drops to about 7 kilowatts. But still, it's pretty mind-boggling. But in the process, it's multiple times more efficient than the average efficiency of a generator, and it's improving your propulsion efficiency. So right there, we can do some little things to improve efficiency. I think the next step up comes with what's called a parallel hybrid, where you have an electric motor that takes care of all the low-speed maneuvering, which is when your engine is most inefficient. And then when you need to go at cruising speed, you crank the engine, because of that. That's where the engines do get close to their peak efficiency. And so you marry relatively small electric motor to your gasoline or diesel engine. And basically, you turn a boat into a Toyota Prius, and you use the same concepts, but with very different mechanical interfaces and so on. So we've been working on that, and other people have. And those systems are getting a lot better. And we just won an award at a big boat show in Europe, the Met Show, for the next iteration of our Integral system, which will have a parallel hybrid built into it. These are stepping stones to optimize the efficiency of our existing technology. They don't get rid of the fossil fuels, which has got to be the ultimate goal in all of this.
When we spoke with Bruce Schwab, he was telling us that when you start, working with electric engines and kind of all of the sustainability, you really come to realize how awesome diesel is.
Yeah. Well, in terms of energy density, If you look at a tank of diesel and then compare the volume or the weight to, say, a lithium-ion battery, it's probably got 40 times the energy density.
Really?
Here's the bit that people never think about. A diesel engine is only 30 to 40% efficient at its best. And the average efficiency in our boats is probably not much more than 10%. So right there, that 40 times drops to maybe 10 times more energy density because the electrical system is probably 80% efficient. If we can, say, quadruple the energy density of our lithium-ion batteries, we can actually get very close to the effective energy density of a diesel engine versus a electric engine. So it's not like we have to improve the energy density 40 times. It's somewhere between, say, 4 to 10 times, which is a tall order, you know, to do that. But it's not an impossible thing, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting.
Yeah, no, I think the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see some really amazing development. The last time we had this kind of systems ferment in the boat world was in the 1970s when we got solid state electronics, and that gave us our fancy voltage regulators and our inverters and our modern battery chargers and all the bits and pieces that we have in our energy systems right now. That was back in the 70s. And I see the sort of technological ferment that's going on now as being every bit as radical as what we saw in the 1970s. It's going to transform how we manage the propulsion and energy systems on our boats.
One of the things is that if you look at the statistics of boat ownership in the United States, for instance, year after year, the amount of sailboats has decreased. So do you think that sailing is going to have a resurgence in terms of like ownership with all of these different things that could happen?
It's difficult to say. I don't see it in the States. Sailing is much more prevalent in Europe. I don't know what the ratio of power to sail there is, but it's much, the sail proportion is much higher than it is in the States, especially as we get to the point where we can make the power boats carbon neutral or close to it. It doesn't, you know, it takes some of the emphasis away from sail. And actually, I just had to buy a new set of sails for our boat. And if I put that into the cost of diesel, I could run a power boat for a couple of years.
Yeah, you're buying a whole engine plus the gas, basically.
Yeah. Yep. Right. Yeah. So some of this is a bit notional. Of course, the other thing you can do with a sailboat under sail is you can freewheel a propeller and generate off of it. But that doesn't work at speeds below 8 knots. I mean, you get a little bit of energy, but it's a trivial amount. But once you can get up to sailing speeds of 10 and 12 knots, which many of these higher speed catamarans do consistently, you can generate a ton of energy off a freewheeling propeller. I mean, at 10 knots, you can be pretty much guaranteed of getting a kilowatt off of each propeller. And once you get to 12 and 13 knots, you're talking 3 and 4 kilowatts. So then it really makes sense to sail.
There was this boat I saw in Newport, and it was, I forgot the name or the style of boat, but basically it had two electric motors in it, which allowed for almost like a powerboat control where you could kind of use the port side or the starboard side engine and you could maneuver it like a powerboat and do a 360 in place. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. I was like, oh, well.
Yeah, we've had rotating pod drives and things like that have been developed at various times. None of them have ever gotten any real traction in the marketplace, mainly for technical problems, not because the ideas were bad. The other interim approach, which is quite interesting in a catamaran, is to put an electric motor in one hull and to put a parallel hybrid in the other, a diesel engine with an electric motor or electric generator built into it. And then for all your low-speed stuff, you can run the electric motor. And then when you want to go at cruising speeds, you run the electric motor in one hull, you run the diesel engine in the other hull, and you use the diesel engine to also drive a generator, and the generator powers the electric motor in the other hull.
That's a cool system, yeah.
Yeah, and then you get rid of the generator off the boat, and you get rid of one of the diesel engines in the hulls. So there's a lot of interim experimentation going on, none of which gets us to an ultimate solution of the carbon footprint, but they're all stepping stones. And all of these involve developing new forms of electric propulsion and motors and motor controllers and so on, all of which incrementally get us closer to a more full solution.
And how does solar fit into this equation?
Well, of course, any amount of solar is worth putting on a boat, in my opinion. If you calculate what it costs to generate electricity on a boat using a fossil fueled engine, and you build into that calculation the amortization cost of the engine, how much, if you, let's say we take an engine that costs $15,000 to install, and it's got a life expectancy of 5,000 hours, it costs us $3 an hour to run it, regardless of whether it's doing any work. If you build that amortization cost into the cost of generating electricity on a boat, you generally find it's between $3 at the low end and $20 at the high end per kilowatt hour for electricity that we get at home for 10 to 20 cents. So it's an enormously expensive way to generate electricity. So when you look at solar and from that perspective, even though marine solar is pretty expensive and then you've got to install it, so long as you use the boat and you use the electricity that the solar is generating, it's a really good investment. And then, and on top of that, of course, it's not burning any fossil fuels, so it's got climate benefits. But just financially, any amount of solar on a boat that gets used on a regular basis is a really good investment.
I have a vision of like solar sailing is going to pick up, you know, where they have like giant solar panels and it's electric engines and it's unlimited range. And yeah, I just think that's going to happen more.
Well, they, there are, you know, pure solar boats moving around. Of course, they don't work very well at night. But aside from that, in realistically, you cannot fit sufficient surface area on a boat to drive a propulsion system at any boat's cruising speeds. You just can't do it with current solar technology. The efficiency of the panels has crept up over the last 10 or 15 years from the peak efficiency on these panels from maybe 16% to 25%, which doesn't sound like that much. That's only, what, a 9% increase in efficiency? But when you look at it in terms of going from 16 to 25, it's actually more than a 50% increase. It's quite dramatic. And in the lab, they've got, I think, as high as 40% with some of these panels now. But still, there's nothing on the horizon with respect to solar that will generate enough energy to drive the propulsion system on a boat at normal cruising speeds. We just don't have the surface area. Then we've got fuel cells, but there's no hydrogen infrastructure. So then we've had various experiments where people have used solar to hydrolyze, to crack seawater, to extract the hydrogen, to run a fuel cell. But if you're going to do that, you might as well use the energy from the solar panel to drive the electric motor in the first place instead of using it to hydrolyze water and then run a fuel cell to generate electricity again. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
And in between, I mean, so what you just described is sort of the electrolysis process. With the hydrogen, could somehow the current combustion engines be converted to run on hydrogen or something like that?
Probably, but you've got this energy density problem with hydrogen. I was actually at a Met show I was at this past week. There was a 1 kilowatt fuel cell there, which is pretty decent size, with a cylinder of gas that was like a snorkel and a diving cylinder, about the size of a diving cylinder. Well, even at 300 bar, which is 300 times 14 pounds, so that's really high pressure, that cylinder was only storing 4.6 kilowatt hours of electricity, effectively, once it was run through the fuel cell and converted to electricity. 4.6 kilowatt hours would run my boat, you know, I have a 48-foot sailboat, to cruising speeds for maybe 30 minutes, and then you've got to go find another cylinder of gas. So I don't see the technology, any signs of it being viable in boats. Now, they're looking at doing it on ships because ships go from one known place to another known place so they can create the infrastructure to store the hydrogen on shore and then load it onto the ships. And then they're probably going to store it. If you get it down to a low enough temperature, close to absolute zero, you can liquefy it and then you can get really high storage volumes. But I'm not certain about that. But anyway, they are definitely looking at it for dual fuel ships, but it's a totally different duty cycle and application to what we're doing. I don't see any way we can make it work in recreational boating.
So you're one of the huge gurus when it comes to all these different systems. What over the next few years excites you?
In the interim, it's perfecting hybrid systems, in particular parallel hybrid systems, because I think that's the best of the interim technologies that we've got. And then the whole time is just keeping a watching brief on mechanisms to store electrical energy in sufficient density to where we can actually get the engines off the boat altogether. But as I say, I don't see anything on the horizon to do that. Right now, for any boat that wants significant range. We can do it for all sort of day sailing and short range. We have, you know, skiing boats and wakeboard boats and those kinds of boats that are electrified because they're used for an hour or two or three and then they go back to the dock and recharge. Mm-hmm. But for people like myself that want to cross oceans and live aboard for weeks and months at a time without going to marina, there really is no alternative to a fossil fuel at the moment. We can make the systems a lot more efficient, but we can't get rid of that tank of diesel or the tank of gasoline.
Well, I think one thing that all of this highlights is the amount of opportunity that exists, mm-hmm. especially to try to come up with alternatives. So what would be some tips in how to get into that side of the industry for some person that's listening to this?
Well, I think the most useful tip would be to don't try it. Almost everybody that has a bright idea and goes to work on it, there's almost none of these that ever pan out in practice. And I've seen people spend their entire life savings trying to make a bright idea that they've got a commercial reality. It's really, really hard. If you want to do something like that, try and find somebody else to fund it. I don't think that's what you wanted to hear. But, you know, it's tough. You know, if it was easy, it would have been done already. Mm-hmm. We're trying to solve longstanding problems of which many really smart people have thrown an awful lot of money and made occasional breakthroughs. But most of the time, these projects fail. And I've seen dozens of them over the years and fail in the boat world. So you've got to be pretty determined and you've got to be resigned to the fact that it might not work and accept whatever losses that might incur. Because it's really tough to create a new product in the boat world and make it a commercial reality.
I hear you. Maybe the way of doing it would be sailboat with electric motor, lithium ion batteries, solar panels, wind generator, and then a bicycle connected to the batteries that you can just bike.
Right, right. And then you get your energy at the same time. I mean, all those pieces, they all exist. And we can put those together into really nice boats with decent health systems and a modest range. What we can't do is put them onto a boat with any decent range without putting the engine in there again, going back to some kind of an engine.
Well, it sounds like the big hurdle is the engine side of things. It seems from, you know, what we've seen that there's a lot of efficiency that are going into refrigeration, into so many different systems on boats, but the underlying problem seems to be the engine.
Yeah, we're up against, you know, physics and the limits of what can be done with internal combustion engines. And it's very difficult to get the efficiency on them much beyond 30 to 40%. So, you know, 2/3 of the fuel that's going into the engine, even at peak efficiency, is being wasted as heat. Then, of course, you can do heat recovery and stuff and get some of that energy back that way. But fundamentally, they're just inefficient pieces of kit. We just don't have a viable alternative at the moment.
Well, all of
but
this
it's actually
has
not
been,
that we don't have an alternative on the propulsion side. It's we just don't have the energy storage for the alternatives. And that's the real problem.
Well, all of this has been quite fascinating and slightly concerning. Where can people find you and read more about what you're doing and check out all the stuff that you've been working on?
Well, there's that boat how-to website I mentioned. And then the projects I'm involved with, they're all at the moment by the Integral System. So that's integralsystems.com. Other than that, I still write mostly for Professional Boat Builder magazine, which is a trade magazine. It's really good. And I do a certain amount of seminar work at boat shows. And that's about it these days.
Awesome.
Nigel, on a closing note, though, maybe, like, I hear you're a big proponent of minimalism. Maybe just, like, what's your take on minimalism? And we can leave it there then.
Well, I'm not as much as a minimalist as I used to be. It's nice to have a fridge and freezer on the boat. You know, when we first went sailing, we had none of these amenities, and we had a big awning to collect water, and we had a really light footprint other than when we couldn't sail and had to crank the engine, mostly to get in and out of marinas or anchorages and so on. I have to say, you rather rapidly get used to having the fridge and freezer and the hot water on the boat. We don't have air conditioning. We've never had air conditioning. That's a huge energy. It just sucks up energy. And most of the time, you almost never need. If you're out in an anchorage, and it's the tiniest bit of a breeze. It doesn't matter how hot it is outside. Mm-hmm. You've got some kind of an awning and you can, or a windscoop around a hatch, but the boat's going to be comfortable. So 90% of the time, people who have air conditioning really don't need to be using it. If you're in a totally airless environment or in a marina, maybe so. But and we do sail as much as we can. So our carbon footprint is pretty low. A tank of diesel on the boat lasts us basically 2 or 3 years.
What?
Nice. Good stuff. So yeah, we'll close it there. If he can do it, anyone can do it, right? Thank you, Nigel.
Well, thank you. Good to talk to you.
It was a great chat. All right. Yeah, keep up your adventures, and hopefully we will have you again in the future, and you'll give us some new tips and tricks to break. Yeah,
thank you, guys.
The future that we're otherwise heading towards. Thanks, Nigel. Take care.
All right, bye.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode and be sure to like, share and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.